The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. The U.S. Open Tennis Championship is in full swing. The fourth and final of the Grand Slam tournaments, the U.S. Open showcases the world's best tennis players. But if you've caught it on TV, you may have heard something like this.
A lot of people making their way into the stadium right now. But we haven't had as many, ladies and gentlemen, please be quiet.
No.
It's as if as the tennis gets better, the crowd...
The first week is the social week.
Now that is how you bring the tension into sports. Caitlin Thompson is the creator of the quarterly publication Racket, and she argues that tennis coverage in America needs a major reboot. She's also the co-host of the tennis podcast The Main Draw, also about tennis, as evidenced by the pun. And Caitlin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So let's start off with commentary. Now, the clip that we just played, a little bit over the top, as an example of so-so commentary, but in general, you argue that that we're not doing anybody good when we talk about this sport the way we do on TV. And I'm wondering how so.
Well, I think you kind of have the worst of two worlds happening, Taylor. I think on one hand, it's treated with kid gloves because everyone likes the tradition of tennis but doesn't quite understand the rules. And so speaking of it in sort of hushed, revered tones is a default for a lot of people, which I happen to think is really boring and doesn't do much to sort of bring the casual fan into the mix. And then because the sort of assumption is that you're talking to a lot of people who don't follow the sport very closely, there isn't a whole lot of attempt to explain the sort of nuances of the game so that you get an understanding of some of the tactics and some of the strategy that's happening. And so you're both kind of talking up and talking down to people in a way that it doesn't really expand the conversation. And so for me, what I find lacking in television broadcasts, I've more than made up for in listening to great podcasts and reading great writing. So great coverage of tennis exists in America. It just doesn't happen to make it onto TV too much.
Well, so what are some good examples of things that you would like to hear on TV that you don't? I mean, I know it's hard. We don't have the court in front of us. But, you know, what are those moments where especially the commentators aren't giving us enough?
Well, yeah, it's a good example. I think, because of the fact that a lot of people sort of are assumed to be casual fans, there's an over-reliance on sort of the familiar names. So that's your Nadals, your Federers, who isn't playing the U.S. Open, by the way, because he's injured. Obviously, Serena Williams and Venus, her sister, are both excellent. And those are all great players, but focusing on them at the expense of other kind of more exciting storylines is one of the ways in which I think there's room for improvement. And like I was just saying, the idea that there's a lot more tactically that's happening that, you know, if you're watching Lucas Pouille, the French guy who just beat Nadal in a very thrilling five-set match 2 days ago, what he did was employ a really interesting tactic to get Rafa Nadal's backhand into the mix more and kind of neutralize his forehand in a way that if you have even casually picked up a tennis racket, you'll start to catch on. You'll get it. You'll feel like you're being included in something conspiratorial, which I think is kind of cool and exciting. You know, when we think about watching the NBA or Major League Baseball, I like when the commentators, even though I'm not an expert in either of those sports, bring me into the conversation by explaining three-point percentages and explaining knuckleballs and explaining pitch counts. And I think tennis really could benefit by having a lot of the strategy and the gamesmanship explained in a way that I think would be really compelling. And the commentary isn't pointing that out as much as I would like, which also sort of fails to give, I think, the layperson a chance to understand what they're watching and get excited by it.
Right, right. So I'll be honest, I'm a fan of basement ping pong, so I appreciate tennis. I've never followed it as a sport. But part of my issue, you think, is that because I don't see how that it's complicated, I don't spend more time to try and understand it better.
Yeah, I think that's one of my main beefs with broadcast. And I think the other thing is, if you talk to people, even people who kind of follow the sport casually, maybe more than ping pong as you do, they talk about the difference of seeing it in person. Watching somebody, even if it's not somebody you've ever heard of, up close, hitting the ball at Mach 3 speeds with spins and moving nimbly around the court that you had no idea was as large as it is in person is much, much more captivating than watching the angle that we see on TV, which is sort of this three-quarter screen that fits both players, but as a result sort of mutes the speed and the sort of agility of the game.
Yeah.
And so on occasion you'll see, or if you ever happen to be watching tennis outside of the United States on TV, they usually employ an angle for the camera right behind the player. This might seem boring at first because you're just watching one person instead of two, but actually it's an incredible opportunity to understand how hard the ball is coming at these players and how quick their racket speed is and how incredibly great at dictating where the ball is going to go they are. And so to me, if you can just work that angle and that understanding either by watching TV elsewhere or watching it in person, it really becomes something that you get addicted to. People, once they get tennis, they get it completely and they're totally in love with it. And what I'm trying to do is in some small way help more people take that initial step to getting really into the sport that I love.
I'm speaking with Caitlin Thompson. She's a former Division I tennis player and creator of the quarterly publication Racket. She argues that television coverage of tennis in the U.S. needs a pretty big overhaul.
Well, you've definitely got me with Mach 3. That's pretty that's pretty sexy sounding. But I wonder, you know, you mentioned the different camera angle. I sort of think about something like football where there's, you know, there's a lot of downtime between downs, and the networks have done a really good job of filling that time up using graphics, using slow motion, and trying to keep viewers attentive. And tennis seems to have a lot of downtime, too, but it's very hushed. You know, do maybe the broadcasters have something to learn from something like football?
Absolutely. And I would actually say if you've ever seen an NFL game in person, it's actually incredibly boring. Watching it on TV is a vastly superior experience because the camera is always trained in the right place. And if it isn't, then you can guarantee that the replay will be showing you something spectacular happening from a number of different angles. Just a fun anecdote for people who don't understand tennis was described in an essay by David Foster Wallace, who talks about Andre Agassi in a batting cage. Just to give you an idea of the mock speeds that we're talking about, Andre Agassi was in a batting cage with the fastball coming at him around 95 miles an hour. And David Foster Wallace describes him hitting every single ball as a line drive. And then because he got kind of bored, running towards the ball machine and hitting the ball even faster and directing it exactly where he wanted it to go. Now, that is something that people who understand baseball immediately get as to why it's so spectacular on the tennis court. And again, if you see it in person or if you have the camera angle to do it, then it really comes home in a way that I think is really exhilarating.
Well, you know, getting back to the commentators for a moment, you know, there's a lot that could be added. So who would make for the best commentators then? John McEnroe, Andre Agassi, these are people who have done some commentating. Are they making it more interesting, or do we need somebody new calling the shots?
I think one of the best things that happens is on occasion you'll get a player who is sort of newly retired, who has spent time with the current players in the locker room, who can kind of bring some of the actual insight of the tour into the booth. And to me, that is unbelievably enriching to know what these players are like, what they're nervous about, what their lives are like. They spend most of the year, 11 months or so, on the road. And getting some sort of texture and idea about who they are based on a former player's recollection is really valuable. And I also think there's a little bit of an over-reliance on kind of bland commentating sort of cliches like, oh, he's getting tight, or she's worried about the conditions. These are things that commentators say when they don't know what else to say, and they haven't really done their homework, and they don't know anything about Angelique Kerber, so they're going to talk about how she's a little tight. You know, let's not talk about that. Let's talk about the fact that she hits a left-handed forehand, and she can uniquely put an angle on a ball that almost nobody else on the tour can. Or, in the words of one of my friends, Courtney Nguyen, who works for the WTA, she's the player that you'd most like to want to babysit your two-year-old child because she's incredibly nice. So I think players who very recently were on the tour, as well as really, really nerdy writers. Tennis has an incredible body of sports writers who write about it. Most of them I want to feature or have featured in Racket magazine. And so for me, even the writers lack a little bit of that television polish. I actually think that's a good thing. Get some of the people who have written for Grantland or write for The New Yorker or for Esquire or for some of these really literary publications and get them kind of pontificating at length. I think that would, again, do more to bring in the casual tennis fan than somebody very vaguely talking about nerves in a way that doesn't really educate or illuminate.
Well, you're a competitive Division I tennis player. You've got a magazine, a podcast. Maybe you should be applying for the job.
Hey, if anybody's listening who wants to offer that job to me, I will make myself available.
Well, you heard it here. Caitlin Thompson is the creator of the quarterly publication Racket and co-host of the tennis podcast The Main Draw. Thank you so much for speaking with me, Caitlin.
Thanks, Taylor.
You'll find links to both the magazine and the podcast at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. There's been a lot of scrutiny on the health of school cafeteria meals in recent decades, but little to no attention has been paid to the quality of our children's brown bag lunches. Well, researchers recently took a peek inside those bags to find out what the average parent is packing, and the truth isn't exactly appetizing. Boston Globe features writer Beth Tytel wrote about the study and the struggle that parents face when preparing school lunches at home, and she joins us now to put it all on the table. Beth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, I guess we should establish, do you know how many kids bring a lunch from home rather than get one at the school cafeteria?
Well, that's kind of interesting. It turns out that more than 40% of kids bring a lunch.
Wow.
I don't know what statistic on how many kids actually eat those lunches, but yeah, that's actually part of the reason these researchers at Tufts decided to look into it. I mean, as you said, there has been such intense focus on what the school, what the lunch lady is serving. In fact, you know, everybody will remember or has heard that the Reagan administration famously characterized ketchup as a vegetable.
Right.
And more recently, our own Congress has pizza counts as a vegetable because of the tomato sauce. But the Tufts people decided to look into what the parents were packing.
Okay, so what did they find then? What did the researchers find when they looked inside those brown paper bags?
Well, actually, it was kind of, I guess to them, it was sort of surprising because what they found was that none of the lunches, so they studied lunches at 12 schools, undisclosed schools in the eastern part of Massachusetts, and they discovered that none of the lunches met all five of the National School Lunch Program standards. And those standards emphasize fruits and vegetables and whole grains, low or non-fat dairy. So none of them met all five of those standards, but only 27% of them lunches met at least three of the goals. So they had things in. They said that there was a lot of sugary drinks, like sweetened teas, packaged foods. Apparently there were a lot of, what was it? What did the woman tell me? Oh, a lot of gummy fruit snacks were very common, she said. Potato chips, cookies.
Yeah, and that's what kind of kills me is that, you know, I understand that, you know, a parent would want to create a lunch that's, you know, sort of diverse. It's got a little bit of the healthy stuff and maybe a snack, a cookie or something like that. But they also discovered a lot of lunches had only bad snacks. There was literally no entree.
That's right. They said almost one in four lacked an entree, such as a sandwich or leftovers. And instead, they were made up, as you were saying, entirely of packaged snacks and desserts. You know what I find kind of interesting? I have kids myself, so this was actually very, very familiar to me, that it's almost like there's this game of lunch brinksmanship that goes on. Who's going to blink first? Because you have the parents who, most parents want their kids to eat healthy food, but the problem is they're afraid that they're not going to eat anything if they only put the healthy food in, and since they're not standing over them insisting that they do have the carrots or the turkey or whatever they want the kids to eat, they send something else just in case so the child isn't hungry, you know, 9 hours after they return after doing some sports or whatever. But then the kids say they don't have time to eat the healthy food. Somehow it's more time-consuming and only have time for the desserts.
So you think that's probably more of a factor than, say, parents who are rushing in the morning and just don't have time to pack a healthy lunch?
You know, I interviewed a sociologist who wrote a book with a great title. It's called It's Not About the Broccoli. And I think the rushing, and she was talking about all the factors that play into it. And what she said was that there was a bunch of things. She said that the goal of nutrition, one, but that's not the only one. She said they don't want their kids to be hungry, or they don't want to have a conflict with their kids, or they want them to be happy, or they've got 12 other kids and other things going on. So I find as a parent, it's not really that packing something healthy takes longer. I think there should be a new unit of time that gets into the psychology of time. It's almost more stressful to be packing something that you know might not be eaten and that might be perishable, so it's going to actually come back. You're putting it in the strawberries, let's say. Then they spend the whole day. They're never eaten. They come back wilted. So even though it might not take longer to wash the strawberries and put them in the Tupperware and give them to your child, it feels like it's longer than putting in some pretzels, because the pretzels kind of have a happy, not that you don't want the kids to eat them, but they have almost a happy association, since that's going to be success in some way, since the child will eat it.
Like you're going to bring your kids joy, but if you give them veggies, it's just a waste.
Right, but yeah, exactly. And this one thing that she said was very interesting. So this is the woman, the author of that book called It's Not About the Broccoli. her name is Dinah Rose. She said that parents make the at least compromise. That's what she called it. She said at least chocolate milk has calcium, at least chicken nuggets have protein. But she said if you think of the cumulative effect of the at least mindset, we're actually teaching our kids the exact opposite habits we want them to have. So she said we're dumbing down their diets and we're pushing their taste buds towards junk and away from healthy food. So sort of like you're doing yourself in day by day by day, but each day you're kind of short. Not every parent, of course, but many are short-sighted. Or, you know, this is something I didn't even get into in the article, but it struck me later that, of course, as adults, most people don't have great diets, and some people, in fact, don't even really know what the ideal diet is. It can be confusing. So some parents, I have a feeling, actually don't even know that what they're sending isn't good. Maybe they are actually kind of pleased about it.
Right. We might be just as guilty as that at least mindset as the kids are. So it seems to me, you know, you describe this tug of war, sort of this damned if you do, damned if you don't. You give them vegetables, they don't eat it. You don't give it to them, they don't necessarily get the healthy, well-rounded meal. Well, you even note in your article that there are fewer kids buying these healthier school lunches since those national standards were changed to require more fruits and veggies and less salt and sugar.
You know, that was interesting. That was a study done, you're right, that was a study done by the General Accounting Office in 2012. Yes, in fact, that study found that I think it was a million kids fewer were buying lunches. So that was actually kind of bad for business for the people serving lunches because it was cutting down on business for them. But more recently, a study was done, a smaller study, that found that, in fact, despite initial resistance, more kids actually were accepting these healthy lunches. So it you know, it does make sense in some ways that kids get used to something. Or they, you know, they get hungry.
They'll adjust. If they have to adjust, they're going to eat.
They will adjust. And also the thing is, you know, I do think that sociologist made a good point because if fruit, for example, most children can actually find some fruit that they like. I mean, fruit can be just absolutely terrific. So I think it's both things, the parents kind of almost dooming themselves by thinking, oh, she won't eat fruit, when in fact maybe the kid would if that was all that was what they were given.
So any recommendations for the struggling parent? You know, I mean, maybe that recommendation is stop bringing it from home and buy the school lunch.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. That's kind of interesting. The only problem, I think, is that, right, but you then have to make sure your kid's actually eating the healthy thing at the lunch. Like,
yeah.
They could buy the full lunch that has the salad and the fruit, but then not eat the salad and the fruit. I don't think anyone's looked into it at that level. But the one recommendation I did hear that I thought was good was to if you're making lunch, involve your kids in the lunch decisions. So say, tell me some things you think you'd like to eat. And then you come up with it together. So, and you know, it's a mix. And that way maybe the kid would say, well, I don't want turkey, but I actually really do like hummus. Or so you can maybe hit on something that would be acceptable to the child and also healthy.
Well, Beth Tytel, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's a fun topic.
Beth Tytel is features writer for the Boston Globe. After the interview, Beth and I talked about our memories of the brown bag lunches we packed, or perhaps I should say were packed for us, back in the day.
I grew up, we lived in New York City. When I was 13, we moved from New York to a sort of a waspy town in Connecticut. And my mother made me these really thick roast beef sandwiches. And none of my friends had ever seen a sandwich that thick. Their sandwiches were just this one slice of meat, white bread.
Like, I also remember what I ate for years because I did peanut butter and fluff sandwiches for something like 3 or 4 years in a row every single day.
That's really interesting that as an adult, you have a clear memory often of what you had for school lunch, and yours sounds delicious.
Our conversation about what kids get in their lunches these days also brought back vivid memories for the Word of Mouth team. So we asked a few people at the station if they remembered the lunches of their youth.
I had the same lunch probably almost every day in 5th, 6th, maybe even 7th grade. My mom packed for me pepperoni as kind of a lunch cold cut. I don't know if that's even a thing still now or ever. And always a can of seltzer. I really liked seltzer water for a while.
Nothing exotic. I mean, peanut butter sandwich, glass of milk, sort of thing. But I always lived near school, so I would, when it was time for lunch, I would just walk home. And largely that was due to an aversion to the stench of the cafeteria.
I would always have a sandwich, either turkey or ham, and usually an apple or a tomato. And then, you know, those little Dove chocolates? I would have 2 to 3 every day.
I remember, it was always a brown bag lunch, always sort of a mushy sandwich in like a little sandwich baggie. And we didn't even get the Ziploc baggies. We had like the fold-over baggies, and I just hated those.
There was a branded version of Hi-C, I think it was, Ecto Cooler. And my mom, being a creative genius, she would freeze my Ecto Cooler, and she would give me a spoon. And so at lunchtime, I would not only have a nice, cool lunch, but I would have an Ecto Cooler slushie every day. It was the best. Thanks, Mom.
And we want to know what you're packing your kids for school. Do you struggle with the balance between healthy food and food they'll actually eat without being coerced? Snap a picture of your kid's brown bag lunch and share your school lunch strategy with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, and we promise we won't judge.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. The first Harry Potter book was published in Britain in 1997. By then, first-time author J.K. Rowling. Since then, there have been six more books, a franchise of movies, a theme park, spin-off stories, and more fan fiction than the internet knows what to do with. And this summer, the story went in a new direction, an official entry into the Potterverse that wasn't penned by its holy creator, a play about the boy who lived, now a father, that had an initial print run of 4.5 million copies. If it sounds like I'm building to somewhere, I am, so bear with me. My point is, nearly 20 years after that first book was published, even with all this other stuff out there, people are still looking towards those first seven books as a source for life lessons, inspiration, and comfort, not unlike sacred texts. And that's the idea behind a new podcast. Vanessa Zoltan is co-host of the Harry Potter and the Sacred Text podcast. Her co-host is Casper Terkyle. We sent our biggest resident Potter fan, producer Molly Donahue, to speak with her to find out more.
So Harry Potter has been a hugely successful series, but does it really work as a substitute for a book like the Bible?
Yes, we absolutely believe that Harry Potter can be treated just as much of a sacred text as the Bible. As an atheist, I don't believe that the Bible was handed down by God. So what is interesting about it is the fact that people treat it with faith. People engage with it with rigor. They ask questions of it when they're struggling with it. They still have faith that whatever was put in there with intention and thought and meaning, and that they engage with it in community. And so we believe that by treating Harry Potter in the same way, with faith, rigor, and in community, that we can get the same blessings from Harry Potter that religious people can get from the Bible. And we also believe that we're offering a unique opportunity for people who, for one reason or another, do not feel as though a religious text can speak to them. We're offering them an alternative. You know, often people will feel traumatized by their relationship with their religion, or feel as though it was never accessible to them, or feel as though they weren't included in these scriptures. So it feels like a real joy and gift to be able to offer them an alternative way to engage with something in a deep and meaningful and spiritual way.
So the whole team is very qualified to be talking about sacred texts. What drew you all together and gave you the idea to start the podcast?
Luck. We all three of us were affiliated with Harvard Divinity School, and to some extent, this project is based off of my thesis research, and Casper had very similar interests, and so the professor who was overseeing my thesis put Casper and I in touch, and then the teaching fellow who oversaw my thesis met Ariana, who had very similar interests, and put us in touch. So it was similar interests, similar sensibilities, and then also amazing teachers who thought to put us in touch with one another.
So you do say in the first episode that the three most requested texts at Guantanamo Bay are the Bible, the Quran, and then Harry Potter. Seriously?
So I don't totally feel, I mean, yes, there are various articles about that. It's not something that we have a ton of recent information on, but that does seem to be the case. And it's the case in American prisons as well, that it is one of the top 10 most requested texts. It is the text that I'll just speak about in my own life, you know, I live with 24 Harvard freshmen, and I, you know, asked at orientation last week how many people have read Harry Potter, and all 24 of them raised their hands. And I really can't think of another book for which that would be true. These are kids. I have a student from Bhutan. I have a student from England, you know, and then from all 50 states, and everybody has read Harry Potter. So it definitely seems to be a unifying text. And then I've had two child psychologists write to me about how it is the primary text that they use in order to engage with children. And so it clearly seems to be not only a universal text, but a text that people use to heal.
So you start out, you set out your mission. There's going to be 199 episodes. Why is that?
That is the number of chapters in all seven books. It does seem like there might be more like 210 episodes by the time we're all done. We're going to be doing an episode in between each book. And then we already had a special episode in this season. We're going to do different seasons for each of the different books. And we already had a special episode this season just because of travel schedules. So I'm guessing it will hopefully, if, you know, we can keep working together, committing to a 5-year project is very aspirational and any number of things could interrupt that. But we have promised to do our best to try to stick together.
So when we first realized it's 199, because that's how many chapters there are, it seems like a very faded number to sort of have that amount in the series by accident. But do you think there will be enough new material in each chapter for an episode?
Yeah, that's what we're counting on. I mean, we'll see, but I certainly think so. You know, it hasn't disappointed us yet. And it is actually the thing that gives us solace when we worry about whether we will have original things to say for 199 episodes. We remember that the text has original things to say in all 199 chapters. So I think so. I mean, the text changes so much, and she always offers us new characters and new themes and goes to new places. We enter the Ministry of Magic. We learn about the politics of running a school. We go to the Weasley's house. We, you know, travel all over the countryside. We see Quidditch matches, you know, on global scales. I think that so much happens in the books that I think that there's going to be an endless amount for us to excavate.
So this isn't the first novel you've looked at through the lens of a sacred text. How does that approach differ from a regular academic close reading?
The way that it differs from an academic reading, I think academics would be really offended by what I do. I don't apply any literary theory to the texts. I do not put the texts in conversation with other thinkers. I intentionally do not read anything about the author, because authorial intent is not something that's part of the conversation when we're treating something as sacred. So it was actually difficult as I was treating Jane Eyre as a sacred text. You get really curious about, you know, Charlotte Bronte and, you know, how she came up with all of this while living in the moors. And I intentionally kept myself from reading her letters. And actually, a new biography came out about the Bronte sisters that got rave reviews while I was doing my research. And I did not allow myself to read it because I didn't want to be tainted in my approach. I didn't want to be picturing, you know, Charlotte Bronte and wondering if my reading was the right reading. What was interesting to me was my experience of treating the text as sacred. And so although our practices are spiritually rigorous and we use traditional religious practices in order to engage with the texts in a rigorous way, they are not academically rigorous. We're not using any of the skills that academics would use in order to engage with the text.
Given that, do you think that any book could be read as a sacred text, or is the Harry Potter community particularly well-suited for this kind of project?
So Ariana and Casper have the same answer to that question. I have a different answer. So we think that a lot of things can be treated as a sacred text. Ariana and Casper would feel much more comfortable saying that they think anything could be treated as a sacred text. The precondition that we all agree upon is that it has to be something that you love, that if you love something, you can treat it as sacred. That said, I think we also all agree that Harry Potter is uniquely qualified to be treated as a sacred text. The fact that it's so easy to build a community over it, the fact that you can build a connection with an absolute stranger just by identifying what house you live in. The fact that there's such a clear message of love at the center of this text. The fact that it's such a generous fan community already. This is known sort of notoriously as one of the kindest fan communities out there that's incredibly generous and very social justice oriented. So although we certainly believe that a lot more things other than Harry Potter and maybe everything, you know, can be treated as sacred, I do think that Harry Potter is just uniquely qualified and suited for that task.
Well, Vanessa, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Molly. It was a pleasure.
That was producer Molly Donahue speaking with Vanessa Zoltan, co-host of the podcast Harry Potter and the Sacred Text. Her co-host is Casper Terkyle, and the podcast is produced by Ariana Nettleman. You can read more about the podcast at wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, filling in for Virginia Prescott. We're now tuning in to The Bookshelf, and NHPR's All Things Considered host Peter Biello's conversations with regional authors or authors whose books are set in the region. Today, he's speaking with local author Paul Durham.
Paul Durham of Exeter specializes in telling lies to children. That's how he frequently describes his job as a writer of fictional tales of the adventures of Rye O'Chanter, a young girl from the town of Drowning who happens to be the daughter of a man known as Harmless, the High Chieftain of the Luck Uglies. Who are the Luck Uglies? Paul Durham joins me now to talk about them. His third book in the Luck Ugly series, Rise of the Ragged Clover, was published earlier this year. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks for having me, Peter. It's great to be here.
So tell us, who are the Luck Uglies?
Who are the Luck Uglies? Isn't that a great question? Well, it depends on who you ask. Some people would call them villains. Some people, I suppose, might call them heroes. Some people would say they're ghosts and they don't exist at all anymore. But really, the Luck Uglies are a secret society of outlaws who inhabit this village Drowning. And when the series opens, nobody has seen or heard from these outlaws for 10 years. They've been exiled by the local Earl, who's the landowner, the baron of the community, and people only whisper about them. They're sort of like ghosts or boogeymen that scare kids at night.
What inspired your writing this kind of story?
You know, I started out trying to write for adults. I tried to be an adult author for many, many years. I had a literary agent. I like to say I got rejected by every major publisher in Manhattan, which unfortunately is true. I did get rejected by every major publisher. And I kind of got so discouraged, like a lot of aspiring authors do, that for a while I gave up writing altogether. And then going back about maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we were coming up on the holidays, and I asked my oldest daughter, who I think was 7 or 8 at the time, what she might like as a gift. And she said, "Dad, you know what? Could you write me a story, one that we could read together?" And I had to take a step back and scratch my head because I'd always written crime fiction. So it's full of, you know, a little bit of violence and maybe some language that wouldn't be appropriate for the 8-year-old. And I started thinking about what she liked to read and what I liked to read when I was a kid. And for me, it happened to be fantasy. I always enjoyed books that took me somewhere I couldn't go on my own. And I started writing what was supposed to be a short story. And Christmas Eve rolled around. I sat down with my 2 daughters, my wife, read this, what was then a very short story to them. And when I was done, they said, "Dad, that's terrific. That's great. But what happens next?" And I said, "Gee, I don't know. I ran out of time." And they said, "You better figure it out because you can't just start something like that and then leave us hanging." So that's what I did. I just started writing a story for their benefit, just to entertain them with no inclination of ever getting it published. And it took me about 3 months. I wrote 1 chapter every week. Didn't worry about making it perfect, just I had this hungry audience that wanted to know what would happen next. So that's what I did. And after 3 months went by, I had this novel called The Luck Uglies. And long story short, that was ultimately the book that was sort of my breakthrough. And a little publisher called HarperCollins bought that book as well as 2 more I hadn't even written yet. And that allowed me to sort of jump into doing what I've always wanted to do.
And now you have this 3-book series, the Luck Ugly series. Tell me if I'm reading too much into this, Paul, but it seems like the books are in some ways very political, and I don't mean Democratic, Republican mm-hmm. kind of political, but I mean in some circumstances, in some of the storylines, the villain is the government, or the villain is law enforcement, incompetent or unaware of what's going on. And
in that way, I don't know, it seems like you're making your young readers aware of the way government can fail. Disney has done this too, of course. It's nothing new for children. What makes government such a good villain?
I think authority makes a good villain. So I think maybe that's part of it. I think you're right. There's a lot of the authority figures in this book turn out to be not so nice, right? Some of the biggest villains aren't the monsters or the so-called outlaws or the people labeled outlaws. It's actually the ones doing the labeling. And for me, I think it's really interesting. I think kids should be, encouraged. I think it's important for kids to question authority. You know, sometimes kids who ask questions or question authority are stifled, and it's, oh, that's rude, don't do that. And I happen to think that, you know, it's important to question authority. You can do it politely, you can do it respectfully, but those are important lessons to learn. So I think authority figures make great villains. I think respect is something that adults should earn, and I think that that's important for kids to realize that. So yeah, but I don't think you're reading too much into it. I think there definitely is a little bit of political commentary in there.
Though the parents, I should say, are authority figures who seem the most benevolent here.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, in fact, the parents are very much. I don't know if calling them counterculture would be the right way, but they are ones who encourage a healthy dose of rebellion in their own kids. And again, I think that's important. You know, one of the things that was interesting to me in writing this book was kids' fantasy literature, for a lot of good reasons, orphans tend to play a very big role. There are a lot of books that feature orphans, and there are literary reasons why that's convenient and why it's useful. But in fantasy, there's not a lot of families, and I really wanted to explore the dynamic of families. You know, in real life, I don't encounter too many people who I don't encounter too many orphans. I don't encounter too many people who don't have any parents, but I do encounter a lot of kids who come from, you know, single parent homes, or they come from their products of divorce. And even though The Luck Uglies is a fantasy setting, I wanted to write a book where there was an absentee father, and in effect, there's a single mother with two young daughters trying to make their way in this village drowning, which is not always such a nice place. It's not always particularly nice or friendly for women and girls. And I thought that was important, too, because even though it's fantasy, it's something hopefully that kids today can relate to.
So who were you reading as a kid?
So when I was a kid, I had a lot of favorites. And I still read books for kids, by the way. So that hasn't exactly changed.
Is it for pleasure or market research or both?
It's a combination of both. But ultimately, you know, I think some of the best books out there are middle grade books, books for middle readers. Really terrific stuff that stands the test of time. When I was a kid, they're considered classics, but The Chronicles of Prydain was a fantasy series that was one of my favorites by an author named Lloyd Alexander, who sometimes you don't hear about him as often as you hear about, you know, Lord of the Rings and Narnia and those types of books, but just really wonderful, wonderful stuff that stuck with me. I'm always looking for terrific writers that really speak to me and inspire me to work harder and be a better writer myself.
Let's talk about that work, the work of being a writer. You do a significant amount of marketing for your work. It's sort of comes with the territory for writers these days. Break it down for me by percentage. What percentage of your job as a writer is actual writing, and which percentage is marketing?
Yeah, it's a great question. And although it varies from time to time, I would say it's at least 50-50. 50% of the time writing, 50% of the time marketing or promoting in some way. And sometimes, depending on the season, it's even more on the marketing side. So, for example, after a book comes out, after a book's published in the, say, in the spring, between school visits, between podcasting, which I do, between, reaching out, coordinating visits, sometimes it's more than 50, more than half my time is spent just doing some sort of marketing to get the books out there, to get myself out there.
And is that necessary, do you think, or do you just like going above and beyond?
I don't know that I go above and beyond. I bet if you talk to a lot of authors, that they're working just as hard, if not harder, than I am. But the answer is, I enjoy it. I like doing it, but I think it is necessary, particularly in the children's market, because there's so many authors out there. There are so many great authors who never get discovered, that you really have, between social media, between getting the gatekeepers to know you. Because when we write, if you figure for 8 to 12-year-olds, more often than not, they're not picking out the books for themselves. Somebody has to expose them to those books. And those are the children's librarians, the school librarians, teachers, parents. Oftentimes, they're the ones who introduce their kids to good books. So they're just as important to market to as the kids themselves. But I love it. I mean, there's nothing better than going to a school and hanging out with 200 or 300 or 50 fifth graders. It's just awesome. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Okay, and I have to ask, tell us about your writing studio.
So my writing studio, I often joke, I have in my bio that I write in an abandoned chicken coop. which is actually true. It sounds ridiculous, but it's true. Now, this was a very glamorous chicken coop. It was must have been the Ritz-Carlton of chicken coops. It was hand-built by the people who lived in the house before me. Okay. It was really more like an 8-by-10-foot shed, but it was very nice. And there were chickens who inhabited this coop before we moved in. But when we moved in, I still had a daughter in diapers at the time. And I said, you know, nothing against chickens, but the last thing I want to do is clean up after chickens. I still have a daughter in diapers. So it was just vacant for a while. And I had always wanted just a serene writing space sort of tucked back in the woods. And I had the guy who does work around my house came in and basically, tricked it out. I mean, I designed it, turned it into my writing studio. And it's like this rustic, just wonderful, everything I've ever dreamed of writing. It has heat, so it's warm and nice in the wintertime.
And how did you trick it out?
Okay, so when I say trick it, it's not your fancy man cave. So I don't have flat screen TVs.
Gotcha.
It's all white pine paneling inside, so it still smells. It has like a cedary wood smell to it. I sort of put those wide pine flooring down, so it looks almost like an old New England tavern. I have an old piece of huge thick salvaged barn wood. That's my desk. So everything in there is just very natural, and just it sort of blends in with the woods around it. So when I say trick it out, I don't mean it's very particularly high tech. I do get spotty wireless out there from the house sometimes. But yeah, that's my spot, and I just put art around things that inspire me to write.
Well, fantastic, Paul. Thank you very much for coming in and speaking about your series.
It was my pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
That was local author Paul Durham speaking with NHPR's Peter Biello about his Luck Ugly series. The latest installment is The Rise of the Ragged Clover. You can find out more about The Bookshelf, which plays every other Wednesday on All Things Considered, and every other week here on Word of Mouth by visiting our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Local authors like Paul Durham are tucked away all over the country. One famously private author lived her whole life in the small town of Monroeville, quietly influencing those who knew her. Judy Bellew grew up across the street from Harper Lee, author of To Kill a Mockingbird, and sat down with StoryCorps to share her childhood memories of Lee.
Across the street was a very interesting family, and their last name was Lee. They didn't have television. They read newspapers all the time and books, and I was very intrigued because I loved to read. One of the sisters was Alice Lee, and she was a prominent and the first female lawyer in that small town. And her dad was the head of the firm. And then she had another sister named Nell Harper. And Nell Harper, I never could quite figure out what she was doing, but she seemed to come and go a lot. As it turned out, Nell Harper became known as Harper Lee when she wrote To Kill a Mockingbird. She was a very different image of any of the other women that I knew. And she wore black jeans and a white sweatshirt of some combination. And, of course, during that time, I still was having to dress up every time I went anywhere. And I just thought that was so wonderful that a woman could be free enough to wear what she wanted to wear and basically do what she wanted to do. And, for example, she would go out and play golf, and I would go over and say, you know, can I go with you? And she was very quiet and very private. And she would say, well, okay, you can go, but you can't talk. And that was very hard for me because I love to talk. But I never had any conversations with her after I got to be, 9 or 10 years old. So she didn't know what an influence she had on me.
That was Judy Bellew speaking with her daughter, Lee Pate, about her childhood memories of growing up across the street from reclusive author Harper Lee. That was recorded as part of StoryCorps and will be saved, along with all the other StoryCorps narratives, at the Library of Congress. Thank you so much for listening today. Music in this episode came to us from Blue Dot Sessions, Eric Skiff, Broke for Free, and Tyler Gibbons. There is, of course, much more radio to be listened to at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also listen anytime via our podcast, which is downloadable and can be found at iTunes or all the other spots where you can get your podcasts. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 here on New Hampshire Public Radio.